Welcome to the Most High Show, a show about recovery, spirituality, and the 12 steps. Produced, hosted, and posted by people in recovery who've been given strength and hope and want to share it with you. If you or someone you love is suffering, we want you to know you are not alone. This is the Most High Show.
All right. Voila.
Voila. Okay.
We're simulcasting, so we're also live on Facebook.
Right, we're live? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
If it gets weird, we'll delete it really quickly.
All right.
But just thought it'd be fun to go live while we're sitting here recording this podcast.
All right.
So sitting with me is Susan B. Susan, you have a lot of letters that come after your name. C-A-C. Mm-hmm. N-C-A-C, C-F-V-I-P-F. Mm-hmm. Can you, before we dive into, I want to know what these letters
okay. Yeah. It's a little overwhelming. It's really not that many letters. It just looks fancy.
Right.
C-A-C is a Georgia State certification as a certified addictions counselor.
Yep.
And then the N-C-A-C is the same thing except on a national level.
Yeah.
And then the other one is a certified family violence intervention program facilitator.
Wow.
So I actually work with the aggressors. That one is a specific program regarding family violence and abusive relationships where they have been court mandated to mm-hmm. attend the classes.
Right.
And everybody gets the same amount of classes. It's 24 weeks
Whoa.
With me. So you kind of get to know the clients a little bit and their yeah. struggles.
Oh, I bet. So, and you don't just get these letters after your name from like a Cracker Jack box, right? I mean, you got to do some work.
Oh, no, yeah, there's definitely some work. You know, back in, I'm actually a retired architect, and back in, what was it, 2007, 2008, the uh-huh. economy went, you know,
oh, yeah,
down.
Right.
And of course, you know, architecture's the first thing to go. And there was no work. And so, you know, I kind of flittered around for a couple of years trying to figure out, okay, well, what am I going to do? And I had already been in recovery myself for about 7 years. So at that point, I'm like, I always knew I wanted to be a counselor.
Wow.
But I just, you know, I tried a couple times to do the, you know, the research to find out what it would take. And I would get absolutely overwhelmed. No doors would open, and I would be like, okay, I guess it's just not meant to be.
Right.
But back in 2011 is when that changed. And,
yeah.
when it was meant to be, the doors opened.
You made the shift, yeah.
Yeah, and then you know, it was kind of like a leap of faith for me to change careers, you know,
oh, yeah.
this late in life. But, you know, how blessed am I to have two careers that I absolutely love in the same lifetime?
Wow. Yeah. So at the point when you decide to go to school to get these certifications,
mm-hmm.
You've already had 7 years in recovery, you said.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about that recovery.
Okay.
If you can.
Yeah.
So 7 years in, you make this shift, which seems, you know, it's pretty appropriate. I mean, I think like at that time, you know, you're becoming or have become a new person, right? Like you have
absolutely
new memories and new experiences, and they're all kind of accumulating. And so that old life, even though we never truly forget it, right? When we use our past to help others,
mm-hmm.
but it stops kind of defining us, right? I mean,
right.
And you start kind of going, oh, well, now I can actually maybe trust like what I might want.
Right.
Because I'm no longer wanting all these things that are bad for me and my family.
Right.
So you make that shift, but it wasn't always at that point. So do you want to tell me when was the first time for you that you found a chemical or a substance to be a solution to your problem?
Oh, my. you know, I started with my addiction behaviors back when I was in high school. So, you know, 16, basically, I think was the turning point. You know, I grew up in what I believe today to be an alcoholic home. And liquor and beer were just, I mean, that's what I had modeled for me, is that you work hard and you party hard. Yeah. So, you know, what did I grow up and do? I worked really hard. I have a really great work ethic. But, you know, I like to party. And, you know, what started out so innocently with me was alcohol. And, of course, you know, we're talking late 70s at this point. And, you know, experimented with a little bit of marijuana. But it did lead me to harder substances that, that really, you know, I could not deny in my conscience that I had a problem. And I used it a lot to, the drugs a lot to really handle stress and give me more energy to fulfill the overcommitments that I had made.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it just developed. And, you know, by the time I'm 25, I'm a mess already, but I'm what we used to call a functioning mess,
yeah,
you know?
Right, yeah.
So, like, what was hard for me to identify the addiction was because I never lost a job because of my addiction. I always paid my bills first.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wasn't homeless. I wasn't living under a bridge, you know? So I think for me, I didn't understand what addiction looks like in today's, you know,
what we know now. Right.
Yeah. And I mean, because addiction's come a long way in the last,
absolutely,
you know,
yeah,
couple of decades. So yeah, I just didn't know what I didn't know.
Right.
You know?
Well, that resonates with me a lot, because that's my MO also, right? Work hard, party hard. And I can remember that being a great excuse of mine, which is, you know, well, the bills are all paid and, you know, I'm taking care of everything. So why can't I go and do this?
Mm-hmm.
And in rehab, I remember a lot of distinctive things about that experience. But one of the things that my counselor kept saying was, you know, you take these unhealthy vacations. That you make all these commitments and you work really hard. And then you go, I'm going to take this unhealthy vacation as this to try to balance life out,
mm-hmm,
you know. And so that was huge for me. And even now, today, where I still have that tendency to, mm-hmm, overcommit, to work way too hard, to say yes in too many areas because I want to do and do and do.
Absolutely.
And I don't think that busyness is a spiritual condition or is conducive to a spiritual mindset.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So that's really interesting.
Well, I know that for me, when I got sober and I started looking at things like I have never looked at before in my life.
Yeah.
You know, that was one of the things. I defined my self-worth by what I did and how much money I had in the bank.
Yeah.
You know, and we're taught that even today, we're taught, you know, go out there and be everything that you can be, mm-hmm, you know. But there needs to be, like you say, that balance. And I didn't have that balance.
Yeah.
You know, because if I achieve this and I did real good in this area, well, more is better, right? So,
right,
you know, that's kind of the whole basis of addiction, right? More is better. So, you know, there were some belief systems that definitely had to change as I got sober.
Yeah.
And this one's a big one. I'm not a big workaholic. I can't be.
Yeah. You right. know? So how has your practicing of the 12 steps helped you to manage that aspect of your life? The like you said, like, now you know that you're not a workaholic. You can't be a workaholic. You can't commit too much to that. I mean, what was it? I'm asking for myself, to be honest, because I'm still at that. You know, I'm still struggling, mm-hmm, with tapering, mm-hmm, that off and balancing that part of myself. So how has the 12 step helped you to do that?
Well, I think everything in life, no matter how you do recovery, because 12 steps are, you know, as a counselor, I have to, in all fairness, I have to say the 12 steps is not the only way to get sober.
Right.
There's
right.
some people that, you know, don't like the 12 steps. I personally love the 12 steps. You know, I didn't get to go to treatment.
Mm-hmm.
I did it in the rooms of AA.
Right. Yeah, it's powerful. Right.
And so, I think anything can be done if the if the desire and the commitment is there and you want it and you want it with every fiber of your being, it becomes a priority. Mm-hmm. So to answer your question, I think everything in life is about priorities. And so if, you know, if you are aware that you have this tendency to overcommit, then one of your priorities needs to be not to overcommit. You know what I mean? Like, that sounds so simple, but actually making those changes is hard to do, because a lot of times we know we need to change something. We want to change something, but we don't know how to get there. So a great example of that was, I was on this spiritual searching before I found the rooms of the 12 steps. And so I read all these, you know, they call them spiritual gurus of, you know, New Age spirituality. And I won't name any names or any specific books. But, you know, I kind of had a hard time because I've been raised hardcore Christian and didn't even go to public school till like seventh grade. So I had that basis already with a God of my understanding and a spiritual side of me. And I read all these books and it was all wonderful. And I thought, oh my God, I'm you know, I feel like I'm getting enlightened. You know, now keep in mind, I'm still drinking and using. And, you know, the problem was, is that these things were all great in theory. But they didn't give me the actual steps, like, how do you quit hanging out with your party buddies? And feel some kind of connection with other people still, you know?
Oh, that's a great point. I mean, I think that's when the, with the 12 steps and, you know, acknowledging that there are other ways, but I think what's fundamental is that it's a program of action. So there's an action behind it. And to me, you know, any type of spirituality that you have connected with an experience here in the physical, you know, makes it much more transformative. It allows it the opportunity to be transformative. When a spiritual experience stays spiritual, there's no, there isn't always a physical transformation to follow unless there's some sort of, you know, activity or action behind that practicing. For me, like, one of the things that really, which is another area I can overcommit to, was service, right? It's serving other people. I got really involved early in recovery with I got involved with the Atlanta Mission, who does great.
I've been down there.
Amazing work there. And, but to me, I think, like, that service and getting there and being committed and showing up every week was such a, it led to a lot of transformation in my own life, right?
Absolutely.
So for you, I mean, how's that? How service men helped you to stay and, you know? Like,
well, you know, I had a few mentors that kind of grabbed me by the arm early in my recovery and said, come with me, kind of thing. And at the time, you know, I have a wonderful husband and two lovely daughters who are now 19 and 23, but they were, you know, they were like 4 and 7 when I got sober. And so, you know, like most people who are in their, you know, the height of their addiction or hitting their bottom, you know, their life doesn't look real pretty. Their relationships don't look real pretty. You know, my husband and I weren't getting along real well. And there was a lot of yelling and screaming. And what I know to now to be considered abusive behavior going on in our home. And the sad part is that if the police had been called, I would have been the one to go to jail. And so I also have that experience to draw on when I'm doing, you know, working with the family violence clients. But the service was huge. I think it prepared me to be able to do what I do now. It prepared me to feel comfortable sitting here with you today, you know? I ended up getting involved with the women's prison system and went up to Alto, Georgia, Went in there every week for 8 years, and wow. It was a huge commitment. It would take us like an hour and a half to drive up there. We'd be in there for 2 hours, an hour and a half home. You
oh,
know?
Wow, yeah.
I mean, it was a big deal, and anyway, I actually sponsored some of those women when they came out of the prison.
Wow.
And if you were to meet them on the street, you would never know that they had been in prison. Mm. And so the biggest gift I got from that was to learn to put a lot of my judgment aside.
Yeah.
In other words, what's the difference between them and me?
Right.
The only difference was is they got caught and I didn't.
Wow.
Like I've done things that could have landed me in there, you
right.
know, and, you know, sometimes that's not always easy to admit, you know, that I'm no different than them.
Right.
And so I think if I had not had that experience, I would not be able to do what I do today, because I interact, especially if you're dealing with court mandated, you're interacting with all, you know, Atlanta is very international.
Right. Yeah. All kinds of different people.
All kinds of people. So.
Right. And I think too, like what you're talking about is a condition of humility, right, that comes. And I see that. I think, like, if when I am, you know, at the most engaged and in my program, right, I will exhibit the most, that's when I'm the most humble. Mm-hmm. That's when I am not the center of the conversation. That's when I'm not the center of my own brain. And I'm looking at other people, and I'm in a groove. I'm in a flow, mm-hmm. right? This yeah, thing yeah. that we get mm-hmm. into. And I love it. I love when I get there. I don't get there as often as I'd like to get there. But that's the gift of this, right? It's progress. Mm-hmm. So today I was very intentional about making sure that my priority was being in that flow, mm-hmm. whatever that is for whoever you are. But you know when you're in it and it feels right, and then things are kind of working. Mm-hmm. So
there's a lot to be said about what you just said, especially yeah. being a counselor, because, you know, you can have all the training in the world, mm-hmm. but if you don't have, to me, if you don't have that spiritual side to you, your sense of compassion and a desire to interact with other people,
right.
Because the stuff that we talk about, you know, in addiction, I mean, you're going to be talking about all kinds of things, you know. And just because, you know, I have not necessarily had that experience, if I've got someone who's talking to me about, you know, some trauma they've lived through, I mean, I'm not a trauma counselor, but,
right.
you know, so it relates to addiction, you know, I can be helpful even though I haven't, you know, lived that. And there's a lot of... I don't know if I should go there, but there's a lot of dispute, I guess, in the field about whether an addiction counselor needs to have that experience or not.
Yeah.
And my experience is that I have met a few counselors who, you know, did not have that experience that were awesome.
Right. Yeah.
But if I'm honest, mm-hmm. if I had been in treatment and I had a counselor, I would want them.
Yeah.
You know?
Right. So. Well, I've used a lot of different means to stay in recovery. And I have had counselors who don't have substance abuse in their history. And they've added value in a way that my sponsor or recovery community couldn't.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But I don't think I would ever say, would ever take them over that, because mm-hmm. there's something about when you talk to another addict or alcoholic, this mirroring that happens, mm-hmm. you know, where it's just immediately you kind of know, oh, I'm okay. Not that I'm these messed up thoughts I'm having mm-hmm. or feelings that I'm mm-hmm. having. Immediately you're like disarmed, like, oh, it's okay. But then at the same time, if it's a really good community, they're going to call you into stepping out of whatever bullshit you're in and into something better.
Mm-hmm.
But I've had some counselors who, because they were talking to me, you know, because I'm a multifaceted human, you know, we're all, mm-hmm. there's so many layers to us and our
Absolutely.
Minds and our emotions that, you know, to live in one little box, I've never been one to really
yeah,
do that
either.
Very well. So when somebody comes and talks to you, like one thing a counselor talked to me about was this positive intelligence, theory or practice, and that's talking about these saboteurs that you have, and that your brain's kind of doing one of two things, either sabotaging you or you're thriving. And so that they did this study, the guy who invented this positive intelligence did a study of a bunch of CEOs, and what he found was they were all high functioning, high achieving people, but they all had these, what he called saboteurs that would kind of high achiever or restlessness or these certain, he has a certain list of them. Mm-hmm. That framework, while not 12 step and not addiction related, clicked a lot of things for me. Mm-hmm. It, something about the names, the way the framework is laid out, mm-hmm. and that helped me up to a certain point. But in no way does it replace meetings or community in any way, right?
Right, because we talked about how the 12-step program gives us, it's a plan of spiritual action, right? Yeah. But I think the other component is to the fellowship and the connection that you have with other people. You can't take that component away. Mm-hmm. Even if you take the God out of it and you try to be more, you know, like intellectual about it, there's programs out there called like Smart Recovery, mm-hmm. which is kind of, from my perspective, what I've witnessed and seen, it's more like a, you know, a fancy cognitive behavioral therapy without a therapist, right?
Right.
And basically, you know, either way, you're disciplining your thought life, right?
Right.
You know, am I going to focus on the positive in my life or am I going to focus on the negative?
Right.
You know, but my experience is when you bring in that spiritual aspect, it's a great sponsor of mine explained it like this. She says it's kind of like operating on a 2D basis, and then when you add the spiritual in, it becomes a three-dimensional item. You know,
right.
You can't really.
Yeah.
I don't know if that makes sense.
No, it totally makes sense.
I like that analogy.
Yeah, you know? I do too. I think where it gets weird, you know, or complicated with spirit and spiritual things, is that. Somebody said this, it's a God of our own understanding, not a God of our own definition. Mm-hmm. So that we're just understanding whatever aspect of whatever it is and connecting to that in the mm-hmm. best way we know how, mm-hmm. not necessarily defining it as this thing.
Right.
And I think once we start talking about the word God, and you start talking about the word spirit, it evokes all these definitions that
people
grew up
absolutely.
With. And they're told, well, the word God means this. And so then it brings up all this stuff. And I was lucky to do a wedding ceremony for some really close friends. And that was one of the things, was like the language of the prayer that I initiated, you know, was very specific. It had to be, we couldn't use a word like prayer or blessing. I think I got to use blessing, but the word God definitely couldn't have been brought up. And understanding that some of those words just bring in this whole gamut of emotions. Mm-hmm. And so even somebody who is just proclaimed atheist, right? There's still something that, you know, who's watching The Watcher, right? Like there's something that's governing these thoughts. If it is, you think you call it yourself, but there is something that's happening. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes I think we get caught up in the words of that.
The definition. Yes,
yeah, the definition.
The definition.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So let me ask you this. When you did go into the rooms, and that was your primary way, I'm always fascinated by that, you know, because I had to be physically removed from any and all opportunity. And I just think of, like, you know, what was that like, the discipline of that? And what was it like early in those first few days where in between meetings, in between when the craving hits you, when the desire hits you, when the uncomfortability hits you, how did you deal with that? How did you work through that?
That's an interesting question. I went to a boatload of meetings.
Oh yeah.
I did. And you know, thank God thank goodness my husband was at home and, you know,
supportive.
He yes, in his own way, yes. You know, it was real interesting for me because I look back now, and I think I was kind of hiding out in the rooms. You know, like, every time I get uncomfortable, I'd run to a meeting because I didn't know what else to do.
Right.
You know, but thank goodness I had a place to go.
Right.
You know, I can have a mouth on me, and I can have a temper just like the best of anybody, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, to learn how to start disciplining that and keeping my mouth shut and not making decisions based on emotions, because I think that's what, you know, people who have addiction problems do. Mm-hmm. You know, learning how not to do that, it was a long process. I have to tell you, man, those... I'm going to say probably the first 3 years of my sobriety, man, they were rough.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't know if my marriage was going to survive. You know, I had to do a third step with that. Here, God, here's my marriage.
Yeah. Yeah. That's big.
That was scary.
Oh, I bet.
I mean, that was really scary because we'd already been married like 20-something years. And I can tell you, sitting here today, we've been married 37, and AA saved my marriage.
Wow.
I really believe that. The work that I did changed my perspective. He hasn't changed that much, but I have.
Mm.
And the beauty of it is most alcoholics and addicts have codependency issues. Mm-hmm. I learned that I was very codependent with my father. Mm. I was about 5 years sober when I started working on that. You know, I was a people pleaser, a caretaker. You know, my journey's not that unique.
Right.
But I think the reason that I was able to do it in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous without a whole lot of help is this. Alcohol was not my drug of choice. So, you know, if you're talking about alcohol or pills, you know, withdrawals from those things can kill you.
Yeah.
Right? And my drug of choice was crystal meth, and I was a pretty hardcore user, daily user, and I tried to check myself into Ridgeview and Peachford. However, they would not take me because they said that the physical withdrawals will not kill you.
Oh.
So they wanted me to go to their day program and stay home at night. And I'm like,
yeah,
that's messed up perspective. I don't need to be at home at night. Like, right. I wanted to go somewhere.
Wow.
But the other thing, and this is still, I think, a problem in our society, is at the time, my health insurance did not include mental health.
Right.
And so I am presenting as a meth addict with no insurance.
Yeah.
So they made a lot of assumptions.
Right.
That I couldn't pay for it.
Yeah.
I probably had more money then than I do now. and I was going to need it for the trials and tribulations ahead.
Right.
And so, you know, that's where, you know, the God of my understanding steps in and knew what I needed and what I didn't need to do and what I could do. And so, you know, I kind of defaulted into AA because I didn't know where else to go. I didn't know what else to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, speaking to that it has changed, right? Recovery has changed in the way we approach it. I think recently, I think it was Florida that redefined addiction as a mental illness, or they changed the designation of it. And in their changing of the designation of it, it allowed more insurances to cover it.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was they called it a brain disorder. So it's a biological dysfunction of the brain.
Okay.
And so by that definition, it falls under medical, not mental health. And so some of those kind of changes are happening, which are making insurance, which is a whole another world of conversation about the business of recovery and the insurance and $1,500 P-tests. I want to digress from that going in there because I'll start talking that shit and then
I don't want to get
then
you
I can't
started.
Back
okay.
up. And then, yeah, but it has changed, and so
it's
has
getting better.
Yeah, and the way that we approach it, I think, is better. So, so that kind of want to bring me back to your practice, right, and the things that you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
When you're When you're doing these and you're counseling and you're coaching and you're one-on-one with somebody, how many modalities are you bringing into the equation to help somebody find some freedom from addiction?
Well, it's going to be different depending on the client.
Yeah.
You know, because one of the things that I, you know, when I first start working with someone, you know, for, you know, obviously I need to know, you know, do they have any other mental health diagnoses, what kind mm-hmm. of medications they're on. I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm not a psychologist. I can't prescribe meds,
right.
But I can observe them and say, hey, you might want to talk to your doctor about this.
Right.
You know, I have to stay in my lane because my certifications are very specific and very specific training,
yeah.
You know, and, if it's outside of addiction or anger management or family violence, then I might direct someone to someone who's better qualified,
right.
You know?
Right.
But as far as the modalities, I'm a big on CBT, you know, which is cognitive behavioral therapy.
Mm-hmm.
I have a lot of client-centered approach and kind of let the client kind of tell me what it is they want to get out of the counseling. Because
right.
for me to go in there and do my own agenda is doing a disservice to the client.
Right.
And so there's also, I've done a lot of training on what they call motivational interviewing.
Oh.
I don't know if you know what no, that's all
that
about.
That sounds interesting.
It is. It's a little bit different approach, and it's basically where you I don't even know if I can articulate it. it's where you be more positive.
Oh, right.
You know, like people who have addictions yeah. generally have a very low self-esteem.
Mm-hmm.
They're their own worst critic, and mm-hmm. they don't need you in their face telling them what they're doing wrong. They already know what they're doing wrong.
Right. That's all they hear in their head is
they need
what
to
I'm
hear,
doing wrong.
They
right.
need to hear, and you know, and the 12 steps can do this too, because
yeah.
it talks about when you're doing your inventories and you're looking at, you know, why am I reacting this way? What, you know, what's the root cause of this? What belief am I hanging on to that I need to let go of
yeah.
that's not working for me anymore? You know, all these things, whether you do it in counseling or the 12 steps, you know, to me, they're very similar. It's
mm-hmm.
just not everyone in the rooms of AA has the training that I have, though. You
right.
know what I mean? So it's kind of
right.
a catch-22. But that's where they should know if they're working with someone who's got some issues that is outside from their experience, strength, and hope, then they should refer them to someone who has that experience.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah, right. And the more of us who become, which a lot of people who are in the CAC training, I did a couple of sessions of it,
mm-hmm.
But like a lot of things, I started it and then I didn't finish it.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, this was full of people in recovery, you know, because I think people want to get in and they want to learn and they want to be equipped to
right.
how can I better serve people and maybe make
okay.
a living at it.
So that's a great point, because you get a lot of people, oh, I want to become an addictions counselor. Okay, well, let me tell you, now that I've done it,
mm-hmm.
it's not as easy as you think it is. It's
right.
really not. And when
yeah.
I did those classes, the first day of class, she said, okay, there's 50 of you here. We'll be lucky if 25 of you graduate.
Wow.
So it's really that high a percentage where people start it and then they don't finish it. And
you gotta get a lot
I think
of hours of time in,
yeah.
in an actual setting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in class. I mean, it's a gnarly
There's
commitment.
A lot to do. It took me 5 years to complete everything.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. And that's without a college degree.
Yeah.
I have an associate. I don't have a bachelor's. So
right.
I'm about as far as up as I can go credentials unless I go back to school and get my bachelor's, which I'm not real keen
yeah.
on right now.
One that's a certification that's really interesting to me, which won't be able to even start looking at for at least a year or two. But is there's experiential
mm-hmm.
kind of stuff where
mm-hmm.
you bring in physical things?
Yeah, I just did an experiential training in Marietta
oh,
about
really?
A month ago.
Mm-hmm. I just love that idea of the. I love the that
hands-on kind of
yeah.
interactions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I'm a part of an interfaith seminary, and so last year we had to study multiple religions, and the month where we studied Islam, there were practices you had to incorporate into your own spiritual discipline. And one of them was, I'm sure you've seen their prayer, like when they do their prayer, they're 3 times a day, they lay out their that carpet, and then they do the prayer, they get on their knees, they come down, they get back up, they go up, and they come back down. And so that was the one I chose to do because it's my dean, who's also in recovery, that's her book right there, at that year said, do whatever makes you the most cringy, the most weird to you. So that's why I picked that, because I was like, this feels weird. But once I did it, I thought, wow, that was actually more powerful because I was connecting a physical movement to my mm-hmm. words and intentions. Mm-hmm. And so that's what really...
So it's mind, body, and spirit. You were working on all three at the same time.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so I had a brand new profound respect for when I see someone praying that way. Mm-hmm. It's to me, I look at it and I go, okay, you're about that life. You're really doing something right now, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that's what I really like about the experiential therapy.
Yeah, but the thing is that, and this is where addiction is so difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Someone can do that.
Yeah.
And still be active in unhealthy behavior.
Oh, right. Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I have the people who I've worked with personally, and I'm not certified in any way, but the people I've worked with, I've found that those who are in a 12-step or similar program, there's a level of humility, a level of willingness.
Mm-hmm. Commitment.
Commitment that is there. The people I've worked with who don't practice any of those things and work just solely through a religious mindset mm-hmm. lack a lot of those things. Mm-hmm. Not everybody, because, you know, we're all individuals, but that's what I found.
Right.
You know?
That's been your experience.
That's been my experience.
Absolutely. I would agree. To a certain extent, it mm-hmm. depends on the individual and the, you know, far be it for me to, you know, judge anyone in my church that I attend. There's some fabulous people there, but I know as a child growing up, what I heard and what I saw conflicted,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I was spiritually aware enough as a child to see that just because you go to church on Sunday doesn't mean you're practicing, you know, spiritual principles and all your affairs right. the other, you know, six and a half days of the week. And so, you know, I'll admit, although I had that strong foundation, I did distance from the church for a while. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's an irony that as I distanced from the church, my addiction went up.
Right.
And as I got sober, guess what? Things in church started making a lot more sense again, you know?
Right. Yeah. So. Yeah. Well, I can't remember where it says this in the book, but it's look to spiritual or look to religious people and what they have to offer.
Mm-hmm.
And when I read that, I thought, oh, I like that because it says, what does what you're doing and practicing have to offer me? And I don't have to take everything. I can take what you have to offer that's going to be applicable.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, look, we can keep talking, but I try to keep these podcasts short and to 30 minutes.
Okay.
And so I'm really looking forward to you coming back and talking to some of the other people who are doing hosting and stuff, because I think we only scratch the surface of some of the conversations we could have.
Mm-hmm.
And really just thankful that you're here. Thankful that I'm sure that as a sponsor, you're probably kicking butt. As I'm just sitting here, I'm like, oh, yeah, this is like, you know, if I was a chick, I'd want you as a sponsor. So thank you for your service. Thank you for everything you're doing. And so if something you said here resonated and they wanted to reach out to you mm-hmm. and get more information about your practice, where do they go to?
I would venture to say email would probably be the best way.
Okay.
You know, I've got a lot on my plate right now, and I'm just now getting back into, you know, I kind of took a hiatus because of my aging parents, but I mm-hmm. am getting back into it. I do have a new office set up, so things are moving forward you know, I can, you know, help more people. And that's really what it's all about. I always tell people, for me, it's not about the money.
Right.
It really isn't. That's not why I do what I do.
Yeah.
If it was about the money, I'd still be designing million-dollar homes over in Country Club of the South.
Right. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So, well, thank
it's
you.
All good.
Yeah, thank you for that service. So if you do want more information, you can just reach out to us, contact@themosthighshow.com. contact@themosthighshow.com. We're live from our Roswell studio. So hit us up if you're in the Roswell area. We would love to have you come in, check things out, be on the podcast, and share your strength and hope. So thank you, Susan.
Right. Thank you.
All right.
And I think your friend Tom D. Giviani, he said, great to see you, Susan. You're so amazing.
Aww. Oh, all right. Thank you, guys. Thanks for watching.
Thank you.
I'll let you, boy.